Commander Johnson, fellow members of the American Legion. I think I've been in this hall before. And I can almost hear that fine old friend of ours, Senator Walz, saying, "For what purpose does the gentleman arise?" Well, I'll tell you why the gentleman arises. I'm glad to come here as your guest, and I'm glad to have the right to come here as your comrade. And I have come because I have faith in the American Legion and in all the veterans of all our wars. And incidentally, the right which I have to come here works both ways. Because just as long as I am in the White House, you have the right to come and see me there. But you know, my relationship with you is not a matter of the past 6 months. It dates back to the war days. It dates back to the time when I participated with you, not only in this country, but also on the North Sea, in the Channel, and on the actual fighting front in France. And I want to talk to you very simply about the problems of government, the difficulties that you and I, as Americans, have faced and solved, and the difficulties that we still face and are going to solve. I recognize and appreciate, and the nation recognizes and appreciates, the patience, the loyalty, the willingness to make sacrifices shown by the overwhelming majority of the veterans of our country during the trying period from which we are beginning successfully to emerge. And I want to talk to you about national unity. Let us look at it as a living thing, not a mere theory resting in books or otherwise apart from the everyday business of men and women. It means that we all live under a common government, that we trade with each other, pay common taxes, many of them too high. It means that we give to and receive from a common protective government of which we're part. So to recognize national unity, to hold it above all else, seeing that upon it depends our common welfare, is just another way to say that we have patriotism. You and I, who served in the World War, know that we represented a united nation in a time of danger to world civilization. But you and I know also that national unity is as essential in time of peace as in time of war. If this country is worth living in, if this flag of ours is worth living under, if our social order means anything to us, then this country of ours is worth defending every day and every year in the life of every individual one of us. And it is because I am unwilling to live myself or to have my children or my grandchildren live under an alien flag or an alien form of government, that I believe in the fundamental obligation of citizenship of every citizen, man and woman, to don the uniform of our country, to carry arms, to work in its defense when our country and the things it stands for are attacked. But there are two enemies of national unity: sectionalism and class. And if the spirit of sectionalism or the spirit of class is allowed to grow too strong or to prevail, that would mean the end of national unity and the end of patriotism. Some people who visit us from other lands across the seas still find it difficult to credit the fact that a nation that is sprung from so many sources, a nation 130 million strong, a nation stretching 3,000 miles from east to west, is in all the great essentials of its civilization a homogeneous whole. For not only do we speak one language, not only are the customs and the habits of our people essentially similar in every part of the country, but we have given repeated proof on many occasions, and especially in these recent years, that we are willing to forego sectional advantage where such advantage can be obtained only by one part of the country at the expense of the country as a whole. And the other enemy of national unity is class distinction. And you and I are well aware of the simple fact that as every day passes, the people of the United States are less and less willing to tolerate benefits for any one group of citizens that have to be paid for by other groups. You men of the Legion have been willing to fight for the benefits of American life. You've been willing to live for American unity. You have understood that this is the very foundation of the Americanism for which you stand, in which you believe, and to which you and I swore allegiance when we became American Legionnaires. But my friends, for several years past, the benefits of American life were threatened. The crisis came in the spring of this year. It was necessary to meet that crisis. Again, it was necessary for all of us to go back to fundamentals. Millions of people were out of work. The banks were closed. The credit of the government itself was threatened. Yes, the car was stalled. And obviously, the first objective was to get the engine running again. It's true that we succeeded in reopening the great majority of the banks, and we're going to open a lot more of them. But that would have been impossible if at the same time we had not been able to restore the credit of the government of the United States. And in speaking of national credit, we're again dealing with a real thing, not a mere theory in books. There is such a thing as national credit. It depends on national unity. Without it, the government cannot get money to carry on the great work of rehabilitation. You and I depend on it. And in a right sense, your welfare and mine rest upon it. That's not just an academic proposition. Industry can't be restored. People can't be put back to work. Banks can't be kept open. Human suffering cannot be cared for if the government itself is bankrupt. We realize now that the great human values, not for you alone, but for all American citizens, rest upon the unimpaired credit of the United States. And my friends, it's because of that that we undertook to take the national treasury out of the red and put it in the black. And we've done it. And in the doing of it, we laid down two principles that directly affected benefits to war veterans. Benefits to you. Benefits to veterans of all our other wars. The first principle, following inevitably from the obligation of citizens to bear arms, is that the government has a responsibility for and towards those who suffered injury or contracted disease while serving in its defense. And the second principle is that no person, because he wore a uniform, must thereafter be placed in a special class of beneficiaries over and above all other citizens. The fact of wearing a uniform does not mean that he can demand and receive from his government a benefit which no other citizen receives. It does not mean that because a person served in the defense of his country, performed a basic obligation of citizenship, that he should receive a pension from his government because of a disability incurred after his service had terminated and not connected with that service. It does mean, however, that those who are injured in and as a result of their service are entitled to receive adequate and generous compensation for their disabilities. And it does mean that generous care shall be extended to the dependents of those who died in or as a result of their service for their country. And my friends, to carry out these principles, the people of this country can and will pay in taxes the sums which it is necessary to raise. And to carry out these principles, it will not bankrupt your government nor throw its bookkeeping into the red. Every person who has made honest study knows that mistakes, many of them, have been made during the course of the past 15 years. I personally know that mistakes in individual cases and inequalities affecting various groups have occurred in the past 6 months, and I say that to you here. But at the same time, there stands out the fact that you know that many of these mistakes have been rectified and that we have the definite purpose of doing justice not only to the mass, but insofar as possible to every individual as well. And furthermore, it is my hope that insofar as justice concerns those whose disabilities are, as a matter of fact, of war service origin, the government will be able to extend even more generous care than is now provided under existing regulations. It is to these men that our obligation lies. To these two broad principles, the time has come, I believe, for us to add a third. There are many veterans of our wars to whom disability and sickness unconnected with war service has come. To them, the federal government owes the application of the same broad rule or principle that it has laid down for the relief of other cases of involuntary want or destitution. In other words, if the individual affected can afford to pay for his own treatment, he cannot call on any form of government aid. But if he has not got the wherewithal to take care of himself, it is first of all the duty of the community in which he lives to take care of him. And next, it is the duty of the state in which he lives. Only if under these circumstances his own community and his own state are unable after reasonable effort to care for him, then and then only should the federal government offer him hospitalization and care, and the federal government stands ready to do that. Now you're a young-looking bunch. But the young people of today, the young people who today, in the event of war, would bear the first brunt of national defense, think of us, of the American Legion, as middle-aged people. And yet, I have a sneaking suspicion that you and I are not yet ready to admit that we have one foot in the grave. We think of ourselves, and with some justification perhaps, as people who have had some experience, of some maturity of judgment, of a position in the community that carries responsibilities. We believe that we have a certain amount of influence as individuals. And we believe that as an organization, the American Legion has enormous power for the good of the country for a great many years to come. It is not enough that you have helped to write the history of the United States and of the world. It is a fact that much of the future history of our beloved country will be a history which you will help to make in the years to come. Your future interests are inseparable from those of other citizens. And granting that your interest in the disabled and dependent comrades is first upon your program, I ask in addition your cooperation in the great program of national rehabilitation in which you and I are equally engaged. The Charter of the Legion keeps it out of partisan politics. The strength and the very existence of the Legion depend on the maintenance of that principle. You are not here as Republicans or Democrats. You are here, as you should be, as Americans, to work with your government for the good of the average citizen. And I am grateful to the Legion for the splendid stand that it has taken. I am grateful for the battle order which it has issued. The realization of our national program, my friends, cannot be attained in 6 months. Reemployment has proceeded only a part of the way. From week to week, there will be ups and downs. But the net result is a consistent gain. The freezing of credit has been stopped, and the ice is definitely melting, but it hasn't all melted yet. Farm income has been increased. Not enough. It must be increased further. Industry has picked up, but an increasing purchasing power must stimulate it further, and is going to. Your task and mine are similar. Each one of us must play an individual part in our own field in dealing with these many problems, and to help make our neighbors play their part. But at the same time, we must realize that the individual part belongs to a closely related whole, the national unity of purpose and of action. Comrades of the Legion, I ask your further and even greater effort in your program of national recovery. You who wore the uniform, you who served, you who took the oath of allegiance to the American Legion, you who support the ideals of American citizenship, you I have called to the colors again as your commander-in-chief, and as your comrade, I am confident that you will respond.
This is the President rapping for order now.
I'm out of order, but I am acting for a minute as your temporary chairman. I have a very pleasant responsibility. I have been asked by the women of Clarksburg, West Virginia, to present a very beautiful silk flag made by them to their friend and your friend and my friend, a man who has labored so patriotically and so well, not only during this past year, but through many years before that, the National Commander of the American Legion, Louis Johnson.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President is again putting on his overseas cap, and on the arm of his military aide is leaving the stadium now after delivering his address to the opening ceremonies at the opening session of the American Legion Convention in the Chicago Stadium. Mrs. Roosevelt, now the President, are leaving the stage. They're posing just a moment, however, for the photographers, always gracious, as you know, as he is, to the gentlemen of the press, the photographers, and he's posing for them, letting them take his picture at the conclusion of his greeting here in Chicago. Governor Horner steps up to the President, shakes hands with the President. There's Governor McNutt and the President now are having just a word together, shaking hands with each other. And now the presidential party is There's the theme song of the Democratic Convention. You remember? As the president passes the Italian box, we see Dr. Giuseppe Castruccio and Senator Marconi salute the president with the fascist salute. Then as he gets to the next box, which contains the representatives of the French government, we see General Albert de Chambrun, the representative of the French government, saluting the president as he goes by. And now we see one of the most picturesque characters here at the, one of the most distinguished gentlemen here at the American Legion stepping up to greet the president. He is Lieutenant General Harry Lee of Nashville, Tennessee, the Adjutant General and Chief of Staff of the United Confederate Veterans, dressed in his blue uniform and stepping up now, or his gray uniform rather, stepping up to greet the President. And there is the, also is the Commander of the GAR, Grand Army of the Republic. He too. The Honorable Russell C. Martin of Los Angeles, California, the Commander-in-Chief of the GAR, he too steps up to add his felicitations to the President. And indeed, this is a typical scene, just as we expect to see it here in the Chicago Stadium with this great American Legion in convention. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to conclude the broadcast at this point. However, when the formal business of the meeting of the American Legion or when such events transpire as we believe would be of interest to you, you may rest assured that we will be on the air and bring you all the facts of national interest to you direct from the scene of action, the Chicago Stadium in Chicago. And now, this is Charlie Lyon speaking, and we return you to the studio.